I'm Marty Moscow. Welcome to The Connection. Adulthood gives us the opportunity to change our narrative, to be who we want to be, the kind of person we would look up to in childhood. That's advice from therapist Nedra Glover-Taweb, writing in her book, Drama Free. She specializes in family relationships, especially where there are problems with boundaries, when we end up repeating old and unhealthy patterns with the important people in our lives. Families of origin have a profound influence on how we see ourselves, how we build relationships, how we decide what's valuable, what's meaningful, who's safe, and who is not. Nedra Taweb's advice is to give up on changing members of our family because it's not going to happen. They're not going to change. Rather, we should spend our energy on changing ourselves. It won't be easy, but it will be worth it. She draws on experiences from her own life and from treating patients to show us how to get unstuck, break tired old habits, and create a healthier relationship with others and with ourselves. Her books include Set Boundaries, Find Peace, Consider This, and The Balancing Act, which will be published next year. Nedra Glover-Taweb, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you for the warm welcome. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Well, let me begin with boundaries, and that's something that you have written a lot about. You've talked about the importance of having healthy boundaries in a healthy relationship. What does that include? What does that look like? What does that feel like?
Yeah, and even having healthy boundaries in an unhealthy relationship is important. It's really controlling what you can and not controlling the other person. Boundaries are a way for us to show up in our relationships with integrity, to show up with insight, and to take some personal accountability for what we can do without making other people do things for us. So it can be even in an unhealthy relationship that we may want to stay in, because every single relationship might not be healthy, right? You know, especially those with family, and, you know, sometimes with our partners, we want to be in them, but, you know, maybe we can't make it the best, but we can do what we can.
Is it a place, is a healthy relationship a place where we can say yes and we can say no?
Yes, when we're able to say yes and no. And sometimes we need to say yes and no, even again, in that unhealthy environment. That's what makes us healthy. So it might not be that I can make this situation better, but I certainly can do my part. You know, I think there may be people who always impede on your time, right? They're always coming to you with an ask. They are always taking from you. It is up to you to exercise your no when you need to.
And is it also a place, and I do want to get to the unhealthy relationships, and I think I can, and boundaries, I can imagine what they are, but it's also a place where we do feel safe, even if we're with someone that we can't quite connect with or having problems with. If we have a healthy boundary, at least we feel safe.
Yes, I think we can stand those connections because we are able to tolerate them better. You know, when our tolerance is low, when we're being taken advantage of, when we are frustrated, when we're resentful and burn out with people, we're not exercising our boundaries usually. We're not telling them, okay, I did it the last time, but I won't do it this time. Or, hey, the way that you're saying that, when you start to speak that way, I will do this. So if we are disempowered, yeah, those relationships, eventually we're ready to leave them. But boundaries can actually help us stay in some of those connections by saying there's something that I can do differently here. I can't change this person, but I certainly can change the way that they show up in my life.
You talk about and write about rigid boundaries and porous boundaries, those being, I guess, the unhealthy ones. What's the difference? And again, what is that feeling?
Well, porous boundaries are where we really don't exercise our boundaries at all. We're being very passive. We're allowing people to take advantage of us. Sometimes we see a problem with this, and sometimes we feel a problem. and we're unsure where that energy is coming from. It's like, oh my gosh, every time I talk to my boss, I get a headache. Every time my mom comes, my stomach hurts. It's like, you're not clearly aware of the problem. Like, clearly this person is impeding on some part of your life that you haven't connected to, or you're just giving of yourself in a way that is very dysfunctional for your system. So it's not really exercising any boundaries at all and being passive. With rigid boundaries, sometimes we can have so many boundaries that we keep people out. We build these walls. We create this tight circle around us so no one can penetrate us. And I think it's our way of trying to stay safe. Like, if I exercise this rule with every single person, I'll never be hurt again. People can never take advantage of me. But even with rigid boundaries, we have to figure out where's a healthy line in that. Because everybody in our lives may not need the same boundary for us. And sometimes we do want to be flexible with some of the rules that we create for the people in our lives.
I appreciate in your books that you write a little bit about yourself, just to put some of these ideas into a kind of a personal context. And you talk about growing up in Detroit and your family. Sounded like there were stresses within the family that obviously mm-hmm. affected everybody. And your way of coping with that was to become, in your own language, hyper-independent. Mm-hmm. What were you like as a little girl?
Oh, my gosh. I was a person in the family where I got a lot of information from adults. I was asking them probably too personal of questions. I loved, deep conversation, very much training myself to be a therapist.
Right, exactly.
And I would say I was mature for my age. I was, when I moved out at 18, it was like I was ready to operate a home, right? I had so much training doing it. I was, left to figure some things out sometimes without the support that, maybe a 14, 15 or 16 year old could have used at that time. I was like, oh, I know how to do this, or I'll figure it out, because people seem preoccupied. It's not necessarily that they were saying, hey, I won't help you, but they certainly seemed incapable because I knew all of their stuff. So, I kind of stayed out the way and tried to figure out things on my own. So I was very independent, and it has, taken me some time to figure out how to relax and receive.
Well, I'm thinking from the outside, you must have looked very mature and very self-sufficient and gotten a lot of kudos and praise for being that person. But what was the price for you to be that hyper-independent young person?
I think the price is a lack of community with other people. I think the price is resentment. Sometimes looking at peers like, oh my gosh, their parents did that, or they have friends who helped them with that. And sometimes I have to realize I'm creating my own barrier. It's not people saying, hey, I won't help you, or I can't be there for you. It's me saying, I got it. No, thanks. So I really had to figure out how to invite people in, how to let them know when I need something, how to share that I am struggling. And I think, life shows up differently on each of us. And so, the problems I have in life, I might not be, oh my gosh, I'm crying, and those sorts of things. So sometimes people think like, oh, you're okay. Like, yeah, you got into a car accident, but you seem fine. It's like, no, I'm not okay. So just learning how to exercise my voice, because I think people had it a bit confused. Like, this person has it all figured out. And I'm like, actually, I don't. I just reflect my pain and my trauma in a different way.
Was that hard for you to ask for help, to be vulnerable?
It's not with the right people.
Right.
It is when it's someone who is not in a position to help. And that's what I had to learn to distinguish, that there are some people who just can't help you.
Right.
It doesn't mean that nobody will help you, but sometimes going to the wrong person will give you the impression that all people just aren't available to me. Well, yeah, that person isn't, but maybe someone else is. I believe in, community being available everywhere. Maybe I don't have the support of an aunt, but I have a really connective relationship with a neighbor who serves in that role. So I would say that, I wouldn't say it was hard getting to that point, but it certainly it was life changing. And I feel like I formed that pretty early as well, like recognizing like, wow, there are people trying to help me. It's not always family. Sometimes it's neighbors. Sometimes it's friends. Sometimes it's parents of friends. And I have to be open to help from wherever that comes from.
And I'm assuming the opposite of that would be a kind of hyper dependence or even an enmeshment that someone might have with their family. Again, what does that look like?
Well, you know, very popularly, we call that codependency, right? It's, you know, that hyper connection where it's like, I have to help everyone. I have to be there for people. Or that enmeshment where it's like, there is no separateness of you and another person. That could be in a friendship and a dating relationship in your family, where there is this, I only know myself through other people. There is no version of me that is separate and independent in thought from the groupthink that I've been a part of.
It seems like a kind of dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So what is the job then of growing up? I mean, we come from these families. They are imperfect. Mm-hmm. Mostly they do the best they can. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they disappoint us. Sometimes they come through. But what do you see as our job as we grow into adulthood?
To become more of ourselves. I think that is the point of growing up, to never stop doing it. Like, we're still growing up. I'm still growing up. I know, not in a immature way, like, oh my gosh, I'm still learning things about myself and accepting things, because sometimes we are clear about who we are, but we haven't come to the acceptance of that. So, you know, outside of your family, as you are becoming an adult, as you are an adult, there's this continuous process of, how do I lean more into my understanding of who I am? How do I undo some of the things that people shape me to be? Because it is that sometimes, that people are shaping you to be a certain type of person, to perform in a certain way. And now, as an adult, we have the opportunity to sort of go back to who we were originally.
We're almost having a break here, but one of the words that I kept running across in all the books that you have written is the word choice, that when we become adults, we can choose things for ourselves. As children, we're often not in control of our lives. Other people are. But choice is sort of the thing that we can grapple with as we get older. Can you speak to that really quickly, and then we'll pick up on it after the break?
Yeah, so choice is a freedom that we have to do something different. And very much when we're in situations, to think about, what choice can I make here? Not what's given to me, not what I have to do, but what are my options? Because very often we forget that we have options.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with therapist Nedra Glover-Taweb. And she has a couple of books, including one called Set Boundaries, Find Peace, Consider This. And she's got a forthcoming book coming out in 2026 titled The Balancing Act. And she is a much-in-demand therapist. She's got a very busy Instagram account where she talks about a lot of psychological issues. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with therapist Nedra Glover-Taweb about how to take better care of ourselves when there's so much we can't control and as we struggle with family relationships. One of the things you also say about family, and I think it makes so much sense, is that families, they're cultures, the way cultures have rules and traditions and ways of relating and beliefs that are handed down, you know, from one generation to the next. Make some of those connections for us.
Yeah, they're systems. And so when we think about, what is my family system? What are the norms? What are the things that we do that are different from others? What are some of the things that gets our group ticking? It's, you know, it's like a culture. And it very often when we like marry into a family, we almost forget that. And we're like, why is everyone so loud? It's like, well, this culture is a little robust and they get really excited. You know, so if we think about it as people have these things and it doesn't necessarily make them bad, but it is sometimes just a normal part of how they function.
I was wondering, too, how we can be, let's say, 40 years old, going home to visit family, or maybe if there are in-laws involved, and you go back and you feel like you're 14 years old. What is the sort of power maybe of those patterns, those old scripts that sort of sucks us back into this very childish relationship that we can have with our families?
Yeah, it's like muscle memory, right? It's like, oh, I'm just shrinking back down to being the baby of the family as soon as I see my older brother. It's like he bunks you on the head and you're like, yep, I'm 12.
Right, exactly.
Right away, I'm a 12-year-old and I must, you know, we have to have these little spats or whatever it is. You know, I think we are in a mode of operating, and to change the patterns in our relationships, we have to make some personal changes and we have to be aware of how we operate. Sometimes many of us don't even notice that as soon as we go back home, we start wanting to be pampered, or we become like the boss of the household, or we step in as like the person to give out solutions quickly. You have to notice, like, wow, how do I show up with my family? How do I want to show up with my family? Like, what am I doing here that I don't do any other place in the world? But when I get around these people, oh my gosh, this part of me comes out. What is the thing here that I can change?
Well, we're back to the choice word again, right? Which is, we've got these patterns, we've got these scripts, we've got these ways of operating and being with each other. But as adults, we do have choice, but oftentimes it doesn't feel like that. It just feels maybe the comfort of the discomfort, if you know what I mean, pulls us back into those old relationships.
The comfort of the discomfort. Yeah. It can be awkward to make those changes. And I think once it becomes uncomfortable to stay the same, that's when we start to make those shifts. And we typically see that, you know, I see that in my practice with folks right around mid-20s to about, I would say about 45, where they're doing those changes within their like role in the family. And it's a slow process of, gosh, I've been noticing for a while that my parents favor my sibling, and it's very clear. And, you know, I want to start saying something about it, and it can take years for this sort of thing to work itself through in that family system, because it's been that way your entire lives. And what we don't notice is what's right in front of us. And sometimes, you know, our families are defensive. They don't want to hear this stuff.
Sure.
They don't want to hear, oh my gosh, like I've been doing this thing. Most parents or most decent parents feel like they're doing a great job. And so when you come to them with information about how you want things to be different, or some things you've observed or things you've learned in the world, it can, you know, can be kind of heartbreaking to them. And it's hard to accept at first. And hopefully with time, they come to manage their feelings around, you know, those tough conversations.
I mean, you have said again in a lot of your writing and public speaking is that families essentially are not going to change. It's really up to us to figure out how we want to be when we are with them. But taking this favoritism example that you gave, where you realize, oh my gosh, my parents actually favor my brother more than me. Okay, if the parents aren't going to change, the brother's not going to change, what do you do with those feelings? How do we manage them, and how do we make them so they don't feel so hurtful or make us so angry?
Well, you know, there is this thing called acceptance. That there is, you know, maybe I want to be in these relationships. I don't want this to be the case. However, this thing is happening, and what might feel best for me is to say that I have to notice this dynamic and create some tools around how I'll show up observing it. how I'll speak to them about this issue, because they may not be, you know, sometimes parents are like, oh, this person isn't my favorite, and it's clear, and, you know, all the things. And, you know, if I were the favorite, I wouldn't want to give that up. It's not like your sibling is like, okay, I'm going to stop being a favorite so I could be fair, right? It's like, no, they're not doing that. So it's this, you know, it's this little cycle of what you're saying is not what you're saying, right? So I think you have to learn how to tolerate that. That is the relationship that those people have. And that you know, the favorite thing happens for many reasons. Sometimes our parents have a connection with a person because they have similar personalities.
Right.
Maybe there is the point in which they have this person in their life. Like, I would try to think about, why might this be the case? How can I think about the history of this? And maybe that'll help me feel a little bit better about it.
I mean, could it also be that this sibling maybe needs more help, needs more support than the rest of the
kids? Or appears to need more support. That happens sometimes, where there's this sibling who sort of appears to need more support, but I would say all children need support. Right. But some people seem or appear a little bit more needy than others. And so there is this assumption by parents to say, well, this person needs more, when in actuality, everybody needs parenting.
Indeed. I'm wondering, though, and as you say, you know, families are systems and they're little cultures, that if you become the truth teller, perhaps, or even the whistleblower within the family, it's going to create some tension, some chaos, some upset. Seems to me you have to be prepared to hear a lot of blowback. And even whistleblowers in a workplace often are alone and have to sort of fight this fight by themselves. Is that also true in families, you think?
Yeah, I think you become, you know, the term that we've heard so often is black sheep, right? Yeah. Like, you're the person highlighting the problems. Actually, you're the problem. We don't want to be the problem. You have to be the problem. So if you're going to highlight those things, we just want you to know that it's not okay with us, which is, you know, extremely unfortunate for people to not be able to speak up about some of the issues that they're seeing or they're having. And it feels like you're unsupported. But I think if you maybe zoom out some and talk to extended family and talk to friends, that there is some support for, you know, being in a situation where you're not supported by those people in the nuclear system.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And that's our guest today on The Connection, Nedra Glover-Taweb. She is a therapist, and she's written several books, including Drama Free, Set Boundaries, Find Peace, Considered This. And she's got a new book coming out next year in 2026 called The Balancing Act. And we've been picking her brain in this hour of The Connection, talking about how to deal with families when there are unresolved issues or even dysfunctional issues. How do you see the difference between, you know, what is a healthy family? How does a healthy family operate? And how does an unhealthy family operate? How do you see those, I guess, two poles when it comes to family systems?
Yeah, I think in healthy family systems, they exhibit some conflict resolution skills. So when there is conflict, there is also repair. There is also talking through issues. Even if there is initially some defensiveness, there is some going back to and, you know, repairing those dynamics. That's what healthy is. There is no, if you talk to us about this thing, we'll give you the silent treatment. Right. We'll cut you off. We will, you know, limit you in some sort of way, so you'll just never talk to us again. There's some invitation to openness. There's this ability to move through discomfort. It doesn't mean that in, you know, healthy families there will never be conflict, but the conflict is repaired. The conflict is spoken about. It's not swept under the rug. I think in unhealthy families, you have scenarios where there's constant crisis. There are so many big things that happen that people can't talk about. There's no one to talk to. When things blow up, they're never repaired. There is no sort of coming back from some of the conversations that you have with people. So, you know, I think that there's this idea that to be healthy, we can't talk about stuff, right? Like, if I come from a healthy family, we never had any problems. Well, right. You can have problems and still be from a healthy family, right? Like, it doesn't mean being problem free. It's how do we resolve the issues that we have? How do we repair after conflict? How do we come back together? How do we accept each other's differences? Not that we all have to be the same to be healthy, but, you know, maybe there is some learning in it for us.
And repair is such an important word, it seems, you know, to, yes. to take care of the relationship, right?
Yeah, repair is such a big thing. You know, in unhealthy families, I've heard about stories where there's these really big ruptures where, you know, maybe at Thanksgiving, since we're just getting past that, there's a big fight and, you know, people leave the house, they storm out, and then the next day they call each other like nothing happened. Right. It's like there's no repair. It's just like we have to keep getting over stuff. And then after you do that so many times, it's like so and so can't come to my house anymore. We never talk about that thing, but now I've cut them off. So that's the damage of just letting things go, that over time it starts to erode the system. And, you know, sometimes we get burnt out, and I think that's why, you know, many of us get to the point of going no contact or cutting off family members, because we're not able to speak to them in a healthy way. When conflict is brought to them, it's never repaired. It's seen as, you know, problematic, and you just need to get over it.
And no contact is, it sounds like a saying, I need to protect myself from you. Is that the message?
I need to feel safe in my relationships, and this is no longer feeling safe for me to be a part of.
Safety being the obviously the important word, right?
Whether that's mental, physical, right, or emotional safety, because sometimes, you know, it's all three. But yeah, I think the big part of that is I'm seeking safety and or peace, you know, because some people, they may be safe, but they certainly corrupt your peace. And so it can be pretty challenging to deal with someone who's constantly causing big dramas.
I'm thinking though of families where, let's say, there is sort of constant conflict or bickering, where that becomes normalized. So you grow up thinking, well, this is the way adults treat each other, or this is the way a family operates. What happens when someone begins to see, well, wait a minute, maybe that isn't how people are supposed to behave with each other? Mm-hmm. What is that process about?
Yeah, well, I think once people start to see that, some folks won't even act on it, because they know that if they raise a fuss about it or if they try to make any changes, it destroys those relationships. And so sometimes it's safer to just notice it and move on. Like, this is not normal, but I'm already in the muck of it, right? And for those who say, like, this is not normal and we need to change it, or this is not normal and I don't want to be a part of it, or I don't want to witness it, I need to, you know, maybe step back when this happens or do something different. I think those folks are cycle breakers. Those are the folks who are like trailblazers, like, you know, this stops here. We need to change the culture of what this family is, and this can no longer be a part of it.
I mean, it's hard to change a culture, right? Whether you're a country or a family, right?
Yeah, but I think it's possible. And I think people have changed cultures. When you think about, you know, when I think about my grandparents, the culture of our family has changed, right? I don't think that was their intention, but over time, like, different people do different things. And it's, you know, a small drop in the bucket of shifting the culture of this family. So it's very different from, you know, even my grandparents' generation to now of what our family looks like. So there are changes occurring, whether it's, hey, we're not going to yell at each other, or women are going to work outside the household. Like, it's going to change in this family. So it's like, hey, this is just another change that we're going to make in this family.
I mean, it sounds like one has to be very intentional. I mean, yes. If one wants to either try to change the family or change one's role within the family, that you need a game plan. You need to sort of know what you're doing, what your end product or end goal should be. And it's, I don't know, seems almost counterintuitive to be so rational about our
wow,
family relationships. Yeah, really.
Yeah, I don't know if it's counterintuitive or if it's a wise idea.
Right.
Especially if you come from, you know, the family that's sticking out for me is like the Gallaghers, right? Like Shameless. If you come from a dysfunctional family, I think it's a wise idea to be clear about what the dysfunction is, to say like, I don't want to be an addict,
right.
Or I don't want to be in a domestic violence situation. I want to break the cycle of that. I want to break the cycle of neglecting my kids or whatever those things are. Like I do think you have to be very intentional about those things, because once you identify it, it's like, okay, how to not neglect your kids. It's like, what are the things that I need to do differently? Because we stay in the cycle when we don't even notice what the problems are.
Right. So
if it's like, yeah, the noticing, I think, is very wise to say like, okay, here are all the frustrations I had with my childhood. Here are the things that I complain about. Maybe these are the things that I'm talking about in therapy. How do I break these cycles with my children? Because I don't want them to experience a mother who isn't emotionally present with them. What can I do to be better? There are things that I can do. Maybe there are three things. It's like when my kids come to me and they have a big problem, I will listen. I won't tell them it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
When my kids want to talk to me about what's going on with their friends, I will listen to that. Like, so yeah, that clarity that, yeah, maybe it's like, oh my gosh, we're being so strict about it. But I think it's actually pretty helpful to be clear about what the problem is and how you can help put a drop in a bucket of, I want to break the cycle and here are the things I'll do differently.
I mean, we're almost having a break here, but that's insight, right? Is being able to look inside and see the patterns and then decide you're going to do something different.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with therapist Nedra Glover-Tawup. And we are talking about families. We all have them in one form or another, about how sometimes it's difficult to make changes within a family, but it is possible. And again, our guest has written several books. She's got a forthcoming book coming out in 2026 called The Balancing Act. Her other books include Set Boundaries, Find Peace, Consider This, and Drama Free. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco, and just a recap here, we are talking about the fact that our relationship with our family of origin is our longest and most consequential bond. And our guest is therapist Nedra Glover-Tawup, and we are talking about how to manage difficult, sometimes even unhealthy family relationships. Nedra, let me quote something that you wrote in one of your books, and it's sort of a mantra, I would say. Quote, I am no longer a child in a dysfunctional home. I'm an adult with the ability to make healthy choices, create boundaries, and live the life that I create. Just because we haven't been taught something, it isn't a reason to continue not knowing. My parents never taught is not a reason not to do better. And that's really underscoring what you were saying right before the break, which is, yeah, we come with all this baggage, but that doesn't mean that we are, you know, helpless in terms of making decisions for ourselves.
Yes, yes. You mentioned choice.
Yeah.
And that's such a big thing that I find myself teaching about, that we have the opportunity to do something different. I get a lot of questions about like, oh my gosh, like I'm in this terrible relationship and I can't do anything about it. And, you know, a therapist in my practice once said, like, you know, I'm out of solutions and I've tried nothing.
Oh.
Right. It's like, it's like, okay, so you have to try something different. And that can be really hard for us. That's like not an easy thing to think about, like, what can I do differently here? Because sometimes it is easier to just give in to the situation, to say that, oh, this other person needs to do something to free me, and not think about the capacity that we have to do something different for ourselves.
Do we go back to these old patterns just because they're familiar, even if they don't work? They're familiar. We sort of, you know, we know the routine. And so even if we know we're not going to land where we want to be, at least, like, here we go again, right?
Yeah, I think sometimes we go back to these patterns because we are used to being in a certain place. And it can, you know, it can be really hard to make the changes, because what comes with that is we have to deal with the blowback. And sometimes that's the really hard part, that our families, although they love us, there is some pressure to be just like everybody else. And when you make those changes, it does sort of separate you a bit, and that can hurt.
I'm a bit older than you are, and have friends who are, you know, in boomers like myself. And so we're dealing with parents who are dying or who already have died. And I know more than a handful of people who almost feel like they have a better relationship, and maybe a more loving relationship with a parent who's no longer around. They maybe even have a better understanding of where they came from, the struggles that they had. And now they have a distance so that they can sort of appreciate what they were able to do within the limitations mm-hmm. that they were given. And I'm curious, as a therapist, how you see that.
Say that more, because you're speaking from a different perspective, and I'd love to hear more about that. Even if you had like a little example, that would be great.
Sure. Well, I know somebody who had a difficult relationship with a parent, and it was combative through pretty much their whole lives together. Mm-hmm. After the parent died, this person learned more about what their childhood was like, what it was like for that parent to grow up. And all of a sudden, beginning to look at some of those conflicts and seeing, well, maybe he was fighting with me, not just against me. And so having just a deeper understanding about all the demons that I think we all have to struggle with at some point in our life. But I think with parents, you know, they're so important in our lives that things take on such a powerful connotation, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I think it is understanding our parents' stories certainly gives us context for their behaviors. Right. It doesn't excuse it, and it doesn't necessarily make it feel better, but that understanding can give us like some, maybe they weren't being malicious, right? Maybe they were using the tools that they had to operate in this situation. And it's really important for us to remember that this is our parents' first time parenting.
That's right.
You know, that's something I have to tell my kids all the time. I don't really know what I'm doing. No,
we don't.
What I'm doing. I'm figuring this thing out as I raise you. And so I'm not always going to get it right. So there are some things that I say that I have to go back and say, you know what? That didn't make any sense. Let me clear that up. Let me look up some things about how to respond better, because I didn't do a great job there. So I'm learning as you learn. So I think it's important for us to know where our parents came from, but also I think at the end of it, we're still children. And it still hurts, and we still have this high expectation of this human being, even if they didn't have all the tools, even if they were, you know, sometimes young parents, even if they were doing the best they could as a divorced parent. It's like, okay, you could have did better. So, you know, I think it's tough. It's such a nuanced sort of thing. You know, when I'm working with people and they have challenges with their parents, I'm always careful about what to say and what not to say, because it's very hard to watch someone feel a way. And you never want to tell anybody like, oh, that's not that big of a deal, or your parents did the best they could. They're suffering. And so I need to see you in that. Even though all of those things are true, you are still suffering.
and will always, I guess, will always be their children, right? Even if,
well,
yeah, if we're 99 years old.
Yeah, you know, it's like Mariah Carey said, you'll always be my baby.
Right.
Right? You'll always be your parents' baby, even if they're 99. And guess what? Your parents are somebody's baby, too.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. There's something that you said that I really liked, and I'm quoting here, embrace a dating-like experience in all relationships. The idea that you treat your relationships as if you were on a date. And if you're on a date, you're getting to know somebody, you're curious, you're excited, you know, mm-hmm. all the things that mm-hmm. you bring to something that's kind of new and fresh and exciting. Can you expand on that? Because I really like that piece of advice.
Yeah, sometimes we lose touch with the things that are important for the relationship, the listening, the time we spent. We have to not necessarily be so concerned with finding new relationships and learning how to keep the ones we have. And a big part of that is, how do I nurture this relationship? How do I continue to be in this connection? And it's, you know, some of those early on skills that we deployed that we have now said, you know what, this isn't important to me anymore, because I've got the friend,
yeah.
I've got the partner, my mom is my mom. And it's like, well, there's still some nurturing here to be done. People still like to be surprised. People still want to know that they matter to you. So continuing to help that connection thrive is, you know, really important. And losing sight of that can damage our relationships.
How do you find the right balance, I guess, is the word, between connection, as you say, and intimacy and, you know, independence and being one's own self, that, I guess, that Goldilocks balance between those two poles?
Yeah, I think it, when you know yourself well, you're better able to figure out what that balance looks like. And when we don't know ourselves, it's much harder for us to say, hey, I need this time away to sort of decompress, because I've been, you know, talking to folks all day. So give me like 10 minutes before I can answer that for you.
Yeah.
So getting to know yourself, and some ways that we do that is the same way we get to know other people. Lots of, you know, internal conversation, taking ourselves out, figuring out what we like and what we don't like, and then applying that when we're in relationship with other people, because they understand it, because most people need their alone time too.
Right.
You know, right. It's just how do I communicate that to another person? How do I communicate that to, you know, my children? Sometimes that is me saying, hey, you know, I'm so happy you want to play with me right now. This is not a great time, but can I come back to you in 30 minutes and we'll play Uno, right?
Oh, like, God. I'm good in the old middle. Uno.
Yeah. Yeah. I still like Uno.
Oh, me too. It's a good one. Endless.
Yeah.
Endless
how do we connect, but maybe not right now. Yeah. I need to regroup.
But part of built into that is what do I need for me? Right. And I think for a lot of people, it's hard to put that me person first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I you know, I know that I require a lot of alone time.
You do?
Yes, I work with people all the time. I'm a mother, I'm a wife, and so I'm with people a lot. So being with myself is very important to me. So sometimes as I'm, you know, driving home from work, I'm like, I don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to sing these Rihanna songs to the top of my lungs all by myself.
And you get to do that from time to time.
And I get to do that from time to time. And it is beautiful. And then, you know, that time away gives me the energy to be with people. I need to have something to, like, restore me. And that's sleep. That is, you know, my solo time, my time sometimes with friends. But I need restorative practices in order to be there for people.
What do you think the greatest gift a parent can give to a child is?
Greatest gift a parent can give to a child.
I love long silences on the radio.
For if a child can experience a parent who is mentally and emotionally well, That is the greatest gift. Taking care of yourself is taking care of your child.
That's hard, I think, for a lot of people. They just feel so pulled and pushed and, you know, under stress and overly responsible for everything.
Yeah, but, and then I think that makes their kids responsible for it, right? Mm-hmm. Responsible for their parents' happiness, responsible for making their parent proud of them because they don't have anything else to look forward to, responsible for, you know, so if you can't be a well adult, like if you could really work on yourself and parent your children, I think your kids greatly benefit from that. Because what I see on the other side is the adults who are saying, oh my gosh, my mom is so depressed. Oh my gosh, my parent is so this. Oh my gosh, my parent is so that. You're creating an atmosphere where they have to worry about you, where they have to take care of you, where they have to make concessions in life to make sure that you are okay. They have to be a certain version of themselves to make you feel great in life. So, yeah, I think if we could manage our mental health better, that is a great gift for your child.
Otherwise, it sounds like it's so easy to I guess, parentify a child is to sort of put the responsibility on them for our happiness or to keep the family together.
Our happiness, to keep the family together, to make them our little emotional companion, sometimes to make them our, you know, our twin, right? Oh. Like, you know, you have to be just like me. It's like, okay, well, one of you is enough. One of you is enough. We don't need two of you. Let them be their own person, right? So, yeah, I think it just touches so many things and it just creates so many struggles when a parent is not able to impart that mental wellness onto their children.
I know you're going to be at a conference in D.C. in a couple of months, the Networker Conference, and I peeked at their schedule, and I see that you're part of a panel talking about marriage in the age of individualism. Mm-hmm. And I'd just be curious, and I guess it's you know, what does to whatever do us part, you know, what does forever mean in this very frenetic world that we live in?
I hope it still means forever.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think the divorce rates have changed very much. I do think we are starting to see less people getting married, you know, later. But in terms of marriages lasting, it's pretty much been about the same. And so I do think that some of us, for those of us who aren't getting married or for those of us who are getting married later, there is this idea that marriage has to be stifling.
Oh.
It has to be like this ball and chain sort of thing. And I think it goes back to the more you know about yourself, the more you can bring that into your relationship and be clear about what your needs are. And sometimes when we don't know that, I mean, I got married in my 20s. So, you know, I'm still learning things about myself. So I'm still growing in my marriage and who I am and what I like and what I don't like. But what I feel comfortable with is sharing that, being open and honest about that, because I have a partner who can emotionally withstand, you know, when we first got together, we spent every waking moment together. We were, you know, like best buds and doing all the things. Now it's like, please go with your friends.
It's like, I thought you were supposed to be dating.
I'm like, all I want to do is sit on the couch and watch TV. Yeah, so it's like, you know, we have two kids, so we're in a different space, right? And allowing people to, you know, change in a relationship and not personalizing that, allowing people to be their individual selves, you know, and not taking that to heart. Like, oh, they don't want to spend time with me. Well, I don't want to pretend to like everything you like. I want you to have your stuff and I have my stuff. And then we have some stuff together, because that's when it really gets fun. When we have our thing.
Right.
And then you have your thing and it's really fun with those people or by yourself. And, you know, so I think the conference will be really fun, because, you know, I think marriage has changed, and I think we have to rethink the way in which we're showing up in it, what we're inviting into our marriages, and how to be ourselves and remain connected.
Well, ending on the perfect word, connected, Nedra Glover-Taub. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And she's got a forthcoming book coming out this year called The Balancing Act. And thank you for joining us on The Connection. It airs every Friday and Sunday at noon on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen on the WHYY app. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Our engineer today has been Charlie Kyer. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.